Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. The implementation of the Affordable Care Act has been rocky, to say the least. Problems have plagued the website healthcare.gov since it went live on October 1st, including crashes, timeouts, and shutdowns. President Obama has taken to the airwaves to apologize for the fiasco, and his administration's most recent estimates suggest that fewer than 30,000 individuals have been able to sign up for plans via the main government website. About three times as many have had success signing up on the state-run exchanges. Nevertheless, the total of enrollees is still too small to meet the projections necessary for the Affordable Care Act to be successful. Governor Mary Fallon opted not to open a state-run health insurance exchange here in Oklahoma, relying instead on the federal government to do it for us. The result thus far is that very few Oklahomans have been able to enroll in individualized insurance plans under Obamacare. My guest today, Ziva Brandstetter, is the enterprise editor at the Tulsa World. Brandstetter has been tracking the law's implementation and has written several noteworthy articles of late, including a recent investigative report in cooperation with Oklahoma Watch evaluating Oklahoma's nonprofit hospitals and the issue of community benefit, namely, how much benefit do our nonprofit hospitals provide to our communities, and how is that concept even quantified? Her results were somewhat surprising. Ziva Brandstetter, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health.
Thank you.
You've been covering the implementation of Obamacare here in Oklahoma. What are your observations so far?
So far, I think there is, in our state, a lack of information, just basic information about the facts of the Affordable Care Act, who it impacts, how much it will cost, how you sign up, mainly because of the huge political fight over the Affordable Care Act. So I've really tried to focus my coverage on just giving people the facts without writing too much about the politics, because that's been covered very well.
It really caught my eye. I think you've done a really wonderful job in terms of asking these basic questions. I mean, what do people need to know, or what do they want to know, and trying to steer clear of, you know, a lot of the vehement opinion on both sides.
The hype. Yeah, well, I mean, unfortunately, the website is very unreliable, so it is frustrating for people. But what they need to know is this doesn't apply to you if you have insurance through your work or the ability to get insurance through your spouse's work, if you have Medicare, Medicaid. So this doesn't apply to the vast majority of people in Oklahoma. But if you're uninsured, so roughly 16% of Oklahomans, 17% are uninsured. And most of those people will fall into the income range where they can get a substantial subsidy to buy a policy under the Affordable Care Act. So it really does behoove people, if they are self-insured, they pay for their own insurance now in an individual plan, or if they're uninsured, to go on to healthcare.gov and check out the policies, check out the prices, because there's a subsidy for everybody who is from 100% to 400% of the federal poverty level.
And you found, so far at least in your reporting, that very few Oklahomans have actually, and largely due, I think, to the healthcare.gov website problems, been able to get through the process. Is that right?
Yeah, they released enrollment statistics last week, the federal government did, and they're quite low. There were 7,000 Oklahomans who had been on the site, who had gone through the enrollment process, but only, I believe it was a few hundred who had actually chosen, I think about 400, who'd actually chosen a policy, which isn't that surprising at this point. You don't have to pay for it until December 15th to get coverage started January 1st. But yeah, I think a lot of people don't know about how it actually works. They've been sort of scared away, and I have talked to a few people who've actually signed up and are pleasantly surprised at the policies and what they get.
Are those brewing stories?
Yes. I was on a mission for quite a while to find one person, a single person who'd actually signed up, and I have several people, names and numbers I'm going to contact and try to tell the story in the future, near future.
I will look forward to that. I mean, we really do. We want to see the face of people who have either, you know, succeeded in signing up, or obviously there's many stories about those that are frustrated.
Right.
So one of the things that is distinct about Oklahoma is we opted out of forming our own state health insurance exchange. And so we rely on healthcare.gov. And I'm just wondering, in your reporting, how different does that make us? In other words, the states, I guess, that have their own exchanges seem to have had, at least the reporting I've read, in other national publications, they've had more enrollees, for one thing, about 3-to-1, it seems like, in state exchanges versus healthcare.gov, and I think more success, more ease of enrollment on their state-run, I guess, websites?
Yeah, most of the state exchanges are doing quite well. The one exception is Oregon, where they had, as of last week, nobody enrolled, mainly because they had decided to wait and to roll out their product. They knew it wasn't ready. So they're only allowing people to enroll by paper. But other than that, Kentucky is doing quite well. California, these states that have chosen their own exchanges, designed their own exchanges for their own needs, are doing very well, enrolling more people, fewer technical problems than states like Oklahoma, who are on the federal exchange. I believe there are 37 of those.
Looking at some of the healthcare reporting you've done over the last month or so, and one of the articles you wrote stated that OCHA, which is the Oklahoma Healthcare Authority, really the funding agency for Medicaid in Oklahoma, or SoonerCare as we call it here, needs something like $150 million in new funds. And it was fairly complicated. Can you explain or give us details on that?
It is complicated. So this is what the Oklahoma Healthcare Authority, which administers our Medicaid program, what they will need just to provide the existing services that they do now, what they will need next fiscal year is $150 million in new money, which is quite a bit of money considering that education and corrections and all these other agencies are going to need new money as well. The main problem is about a third of that comes from a $50 million cut in the federal government reimbursement rate. It's caused by a formula. Basically, our per capita income in Oklahoma went up, which is good news, but the number of people needing Medicaid continues to rise as well. Because of that per capita income increase, the federal government decreased its match, the amount of money it gives Oklahoma. So we lost $50 million right there in Medicaid. The rest is one-time money that the state, that the agency needs to replace, that it received this year, that it will need to receive next year just to stay current. And also the growth in the Medicaid program. There are more people needing more services and more sick people who are more expensive to care for.
Is it likely we're going to be able, OCHA, the healthcare authority, will be able to recoup those funds or find that money somewhere?
You know, they're really looking at efficiencies. The legislature is starting a conversation about this issue because they've seen the numbers go up every year, the amount of budget. It is the number three agency in terms of the size of its budget and the amount of money it consumes, which I think a lot of people aren't aware of. That number of Medicaid, people on Medicaid in Oklahoma has just gone up and up and up the last 15, 20 years. But it's a reflection of our economy. They're trying to create efficiencies in every way possible. I covered their meeting this month, and they have essentially a managed care program where they have something called a patient-centered medical home that really does coordinate care for these very sick people. There's about 825,000 people in Oklahoma on Medicaid, and more than half of those are children. The rest are disabled people and pregnant women. So there's not a large number of working adults who are not disabled on this program.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann sitting in for Rich Fisher today. My guest is Ziva Brandstetter, the enterprise editor of the Tulsa World, who has been reporting, investigating the rollout of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, here in Oklahoma. And I was particularly struck by really a lengthy, sort of a Sunday investigative feature, if you will, that you did with Clifton Adcock of Oklahoma Watch. And that was really looking at nonprofit hospitals in Oklahoma and what they provide in terms of community benefit or charity care. So how do hospitals, or how do you, as the journalist, define charity care?
Yeah, so that is essentially care that a hospital provides to a patient that it expects to get no payment for in return. These aren't just people who don't want to pay their bills. They're people who cannot pay their bills. And hospitals generally have people fill out information about whether they have insurance, what their annual income is, that kind of thing. And so they know who these folks are. And so charity care is defined as the number of people, the amount of money that a hospital essentially loses on these folks who can't afford to pay their bills.
Typically, we'll write that off as debt or redefine it as charity care.
Correct.
And so if you're a not-for-profit hospital, you're tax-exempt, as it were. And so the expectation, I think, from the state or the tax code is really that the law says you provide community benefit. And one of the ways in which community benefit is defined is as charity care.
Correct. Yeah, there's been some interesting changes in that over the years. I believe in the 60s, there actually was a level that was required by the federal government. Since then, there's been no specific limit set for charity care that nonprofit hospitals and government-operated hospitals have to provide for their tax exemption. So these hospitals are, some of them are quite large. There's a nonprofit hospital in Tulsa that has $800 million in annual revenue, five people on its payroll that earn $1 million or more. And that's pretty typical of these large nonprofit hospitals. So they're essentially a big business. And in return for that tax break, which amounts to $6 billion a year for the entire country, all of the nonprofit hospitals, they have to provide this charity care and they have to report it. They also provide other community benefits like health fairs, targeted programs to help, let's say, children with asthma, specific things like that, training. They can also count the loss that they take on caring for Medicaid patients because it doesn't pay the entire cost of the care. They can count that as a community benefit. So charity care is a piece of the larger community benefit pie. Generally, these hospitals that are nonprofit are required to provide charity care.
So what were some of the ranges you saw? You looked at pretty much all of the hospitals in Oklahoma, and you found some surprising things. I mean, some hospitals seem to be doing a very large amount of charity care, while others were maybe a bit more surprising in how little charity care they seemed to be offering.
Yeah, we found that that range was quite interesting. One thing to realize is that Oklahoma does not require any specific level of charity care like the federal government. Five states actually do. So a good benchmark was Texas. They require 4% of the net patient revenue to be provided in charity care and 1% in other kinds of community benefits. So that's sort of a standard that we looked at. And the average in the state among all hospitals was 2.7% of net patient revenues. So this is after you've taken off your payroll costs and everything and what you have left over. And 2.7% was the average. There were hospitals that, 40 of them, nonprofit hospitals and government-operated hospitals, that provided less than 1% of net patient revenue in the form of charity care, which we found probably surprising.
Well, this is really good investigative journalism. And so has there been a lot of feedback or a lot of response to that article? And you mentioned the sidebar article, which was about the 40 hospitals providing less than 1% charity care. What have you heard from, I guess, the community or the readers or letters to the editor?
Yeah, I actually got a lot of emails from people in the medical community, people in the nonprofit community who said, we're really glad that you did this story. It's hospital finance is so complicated that very few people are willing, journalists are willing to delve into this realm. And certainly the public's not going to do this kind of research. So that's really our watchdog role. But I got a lot of emails, phone calls, people who appreciated that we'd done it. They said sort of, you don't know the half of it, was kind of the response that I got from many people. I was a little disappointed in the lack of response that we received from policymakers. And I would hope that these stories could generate a conversation among our lawmakers about what the responsibilities are of these hospitals to the community.
I know of one case in Illinois where the Attorney General of Illinois stripped a hospital system of its tax-exempt status for, I think, failure to provide enough community benefit as it was defined. Mm-hmm. Is that the kind of thing you think could happen in Oklahoma?
I don't see that happening in Oklahoma. There are several states that have done that. Illinois is the latest. I believe that was in 2010. I don't see that happening in Oklahoma. Really, I think what would be worth perhaps an interim study is whether there should be some benchmark in exchange for the state tax break we give these hospitals, because not only do they not pay federal taxes, they don't pay state taxes. And so it might be interesting to look at what would happen if we required a benchmark. There are unintended consequences. So in Texas, when they instituted this 5% benchmark, hospitals that were doing more than that, they found did less in some cases. So you do have to think about that. But, you know, I think lawmakers should at least look at this and study what the impacts would be. We did find hospitals doing well over this average. Oklahoma State University Medical Center, OU Medical Center, as, you know, our state's sort of safety net teaching hospitals, were doing in the realm of 9%, 11% or so net patient revenues were charity care.
They're also, of course, providing the community benefit of teaching, which I'm a part of.
Correct.
It's a disclaimer. Here in OU at the School of Community Medicine.
It's an important benefit.
So I mentioned that you had done this piece particularly in conjunction with something called Oklahoma Watch. Oklahoma Watch, as I understand it, is a nonprofit investigative journalism group. I mean,
correct.
How would you describe them, and how did your partnership with them come about?
Yeah, so Oklahoma Watch started several years ago in Oklahoma. The primary funders are two foundations, the George Kaiser Family Foundation and the Ethics and Excellence Foundation. Both are very good foundations. Their only interest is in providing quality investigative reporting on issues that are important to the community. So beyond that, Oklahoma Watch delves into healthcare policy issues, education policy, issues regarding corrections. So the first project the Tulsa World did with them was a project called Women in Prison, and it looked at why Oklahoma is number one in the nation in locking up women. And so from there, we've done several large projects with them, and this was the most recent. And they are part of a growing trend in the country with nonprofit investigative journalism organizations. So as newspapers have cut back on payroll and there have been layoffs in journalism, a lot of nonprofit organizations have stepped in to fill that void.
And depending on, I guess, who you read or how what you believe, how viable is the nonprofit investigative journalism model? I mean, I guess we can hope it's got viability and that it will continue because they seem to do great work. And, of course, another one I think nationally known I see a lot is ProPublica, right?
Yeah.
Is that, so they do a lot of investigative journalism, particularly, I think, in the financial area in terms of Wall Street and investigative stuff in the wake of the global financial meltdown in 2008. Done some really excellent reporting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see at the Tulsa World, you know, more future collaborations with Oklahoma Watch?
Definitely. We really worked well together in this project. This was their data that they brought to us and asked us. We have some really talented data analysts who are good at looking at data in depth. So we really worked well together, enjoyed the collaboration, definitely plan to continue collaborating with Oklahoma Watch on future topics where it makes sense, gives us sort of a statewide approach. What they do is they produce investigative work and then they distribute it through their media partners, such as the Tulsa World, the Oklahoman, any other media outlet that cares to use the reporting. And, as far as the financial model, there are certainly organizations like ProPublica, the Center for Investigative Reporting. There's an umbrella organization called Investigative News Network. There are more than 80 members, 80 nonprofit organizations across the country. It remains to be seen whether they're financially viable. You have to either charge for your product or find grants or get people to pay for the product. And it's not easy getting people to pay for content. We all expect free content on the web now.
Yeah, so. I mean, we've seen nothing short of a utter transition or, in your industry, in journalism. I mean, it's been very difficult for the established players to continue. And, Tulsa World is an example, right? So the paper was sold and is now, like many urban newspapers, moving toward, digital model. How has the move to digital affected your reporting? Or, I mean, are you on a tighter deadline in terms of trying to develop content for, web deadlines?
Well, it's certainly in the last, I would say, 5 years, changed the way we do our business. So I used to work at the Tulsa Tribune, and it was an afternoon paper, and we would get our copy ready for the deadline, and then we would start working on the next day's product without any pressure. Now, as soon as something happens, something important, we need to be first, but my mantra is I would rather be right than first if I'm going to have to choose between those two. So it has put pressure on breaking news, on journalists in terms of getting breaking news first, getting it right, having a mechanism to report those things in a breaking news way. But as far as the work that I do and my team does, the web provides just an infinite number of possibilities for us in terms of presenting data to people. We can, for example, with the hospital story, we can put the whole database online and let people plug in their city, plug in their zip code, and look up their data. We have our state payroll online. That's a very popular database. People can go look up the salaries of any state employee. So it allows us to map information. We just did a big project on foreclosures, and we had lots of data on there that, we couldn't display in the confines of the print product. So it's actually really exciting and provides a lot of new possibilities for us in investigative reporting.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann sitting in for Rich Fisher today. Our guest is Eva Brandstetter, enterprise editor at the Tulsa World, and we're talking about some of the transformation that's gone on in the journalism industry in addition to her recent reporting on the Obamacare rollout. I noticed, too, when you talked about multimedia and how using the web offers you the opportunity to provide data in a rich way that you aren't able to in a broadsheet or newspaper format. I also noticed, are you branching out more into video as well?
Yeah, definitely. That's it's interesting how the platforms, so television, radio, print, are sort of converging. And each medium, I think, has realized that we need to offer as many ways to tell the story as possible. And we are presenting more video on our site. Generally, our photojournalists will produce videos of important stories, and then we'll also try to acquire video in breaking news situations. Let's say an agency may have some dash cam video. We have gone to court over that, and the court decisions have all been in favor of the public nature of those records. So, yes, we're definitely interested in video, interested in telling the story in as many ways and in the best way as possible.
Yeah, and obviously having content delivered in many ways just enhances your ability to tell the stories. You mentioned in terms of your reporting that you have a relatively long career. And I'm wondering, have you always been an investigative journalist, or have you done other types of journalism?
Well, of course, nobody starts out doing this kind of work. You have to kind of earn the right to do it. But I remember my first interview at the Tulsa Tribune, the managing editor's name was Windsor Ridenour, said, what do you want to do long term? And I said, I want to be an investigative reporter. And he said, why? And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, I have to have a good answer for this, but I don't really know how to verbalize it. And he said, is it because you want to make a difference in the world? And I said, that's it. That's exactly why. So I feel just so fortunate to be able to do this work. I would say I started doing investigative reporting on a beat. So when I was the city hall reporter, for example, I started hearing about poultry waste and the impact that's having in our water, city of Tulsa, and started doing more in-depth reporting that way. So I kind of worked my way into the job, and I don't want to do anything else. I'm really, really fortunate to be able to do this work.
I want to shift back to your recent work, the recent series. Another partnership article that you did with Oklahoma Watch was about the smaller hospitals in Oklahoma and really what a pretty much desperate financial situation many of them are in. What led you to that story, and you know, what impact have you seen from that?
Yeah, so we had all heard and been doing stories about the pressures that rural hospitals were under. A number of them have closed or have been in jeopardy of closing. Paul's Valley General Hospital has declared bankruptcy, although it's still open. We have a doctor shortage in the rural area. So sort of anecdotally, we've been hearing this in stories, and we wanted to quantify that. So we Oklahoma Watch was able to obtain cost report data from the federal government. So hospitals have to provide these reports to the federal government to say what their costs and what their revenues are. So we were able to plug all that into a spreadsheet and do some analysis, and found out that definitely majority of these small hospitals, so 100 beds and under, were losing money, had lost money. We looked at 2009 through 2012, and many of them had lost money in several of those years. So a majority of Oklahoma hospitals that are 100 beds and under were losing money, some to the tune of, you know, 100% loss in 1 year, the Stroud Hospital. It was amazing to see the losses that some of these hospitals are sustaining and still trying to serve their communities.
So tying the two stories together, and perhaps they don't fit together, but my understanding of the Affordable Care Act was that by insuring more individuals, I mean, the larger goal of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, was to get the large number, the tens of millions of folks who are uninsured, onto the insurance rolls. And the reason that the hospital associations, like the American Hospital Association or the Oklahoma Hospital Association, signed on to this national plan was because they said, we're losing a lot of money caring for uninsured individuals or underinsured individuals, but now if we have patients who are insured, this will, you know, help us meet our costs or help us with improve our revenue. And because, for example, in Oklahoma, we haven't expanded Medicaid, this has really put a double whammy, because the federal government is also reducing subsidies to hospitals that don't do what they call disproportionate share. Is that right?
Correct. Yes. Hospitals, they call
dish
them.
Hospitals. So our rural hospitals are really feeling the brunt of this.
Yeah. I even the large nonprofit hospitals that I talked to said, we sort of feel like, you know, we held up our end of the bargain and then didn't get what we were promised as a, you know, as an entity. When Oklahoma rejected the Medicaid expansion, it did put our hospitals in a very difficult situation. So they're going to have more uninsured people. They're going to have continue to lose money on every Medicaid patient they treat. Meanwhile, their Medicaid reimbursement rates are being cut as per the agreement with the administration to pass the Affordable Care Act. So the hospital association supported it, and with the understanding that they would have more insured people, just like you said. And the Supreme Court, of course, ruled that the Medicaid expansion was optional, that states could reject it. About half the states in the country have done so, leaving millions of people uninsured. And, you know, whether you agree with the policy or not, it does leave about 150,000 people in Oklahoma in a gap. So they're too poor to qualify for the subsidies under the Affordable Care Act, and yet won't qualify for Medicaid.
So really almost no option pending a change in, I mean, I guess, government status or enrolling the plan, or coming up with something along the lines of Insure Oklahoma that would, in a way, subsidize that large group. So you also reported on the President Obama's almost amendment recently, just I think a week ago or so, that he said he was being lambasted, I think, mm-hmm. in the press and in public opinion because of the fact he had made the pledge that if you have insurance you like, you can keep the insurance you have. And it turned out that really wasn't the case, at least in the individual market. If you had a plan from your employer, you were by and large going to keep getting insured. But if you had an individual plan, it turned out that the insurance companies were consolidating people into so-called Obamacare plans so that, in fact, they sent letters out saying, well, in fact, we're discontinuing your current policy. And so it seemed mm-hmm. like that pledge was broken. So he was taking such heat, he did a press conference and then went out and said, well, actually, we're changing the rule. We're going to now allow you to keep your insurance if you can. And I think that created a lot of uncertainty. I think one interpretation of it was that he was trying to put the onus back on the insurance companies. I guess in your reporting, it seemed fairly confusing. Can you help straighten us out on that?
It is confusing. So the administration grandfathered in plans in 2010 when this law passed. They said, okay, all the plans that don't qualify now because they have to provide a set of essential health benefits like maternity care, ambulance, transports, that kind of thing. So all the plans that didn't cover that, they said, we're going to grandfather you in. What they didn't count on is the number of insurance companies that would continue to sell plans that they knew would not qualify for this law once it took effect. So it was all those policies that post-2010 were written by insurance companies. Interesting thing is these folks are getting these cancellation notices. They probably can qualify, depending on their income, for better coverage under the Affordable Care Act. But it's a scary thing to lose your insurance. And a lot of the younger health – the risk is a lot of the younger, healthier people will stay with those old bare-bones policies now that the administration has allowed these substandard plans to continue. And then only the sick people will jump onto the exchange, and that will create a big problem for insurance companies.
Now, Ziva Branstetter, you mentioned that you have some names and numbers of folks who have successfully gone through the healthcare.gov registration mm-hmm. process and actually enrolled and, I guess, have bought insurance or will be buying insurance successfully. So we have that to look forward to. What else? Are there any previews you can share with us or any scoops you can give us?
On the
Affordable Care Act or healthcare in Oklahoma or other investigative pieces that you're thinking about or working on you'd be willing to share on the
Yeah, definitely. I am very interested in continuing to explore the issues of healthcare. I think it's just all of these issues are so important right now and part of the national discussion. I'm very interested in these folks who fell into this gap. So I met a man named Kevin Bolander who does not qualify for Medicaid, does not qualify for the Affordable Care Act because he's too poor, and he has a seizure disorder, so he can't work. So I want to put a face on that group of folks who won't qualify for anything in Oklahoma. I also want to continue looking at the charity care issue and these hospitals that don't provide much charity care and maybe drill down into that a little bit more. One other thing I'm thinking about writing about is Social Security and how Oklahoma leads the nation in the number of Social Security appeals. So these are folks that were denied disability status and have essentially sued to get that. And I think it's interesting that we lead the nation there, and I'm going to look into that. One other issue I'm interested in is medical bankruptcies. So folks that have filed bankruptcy due to medical bills, I think there are a lot of them out there, and I'd like to quantify that.
Well, Ziva Branstetter, it's been wonderful talking to you. I really look forward to those future pieces, and I just want to congratulate you because you've done such a good job, I think, so far of continuing to really report on this story and educate all of us.
I appreciate the time, and these are really important issues, and I appreciate the time today to talk about them.
Thanks so much. Ziva Branstetter is the enterprise editor at the Tulsa World. Well, that's Studio Tulsa on Health for today. Our show is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. Opinions expressed on Studio Tulsa are those of our guests and commentators and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed a recent show or want more information about our guests, take a look at our website at publicradiotulsa.org. There you can look up Studio Tulsa to read and listen anytime. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.